Charlotte Talks just marked its 22nd year on the air on WFAE. When the show launched, Charlotte was wrestling with growth, the role of race in public schools, transportation. There were big bank mergers, and the country was headed toward a presidential impeachment. The more things change, huh? What hasn't changed is the importance of listeners' financial support. Click the donate button at WFAE.org or call 704-549-9000. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, pushback from some CMS teachers over the system's plan to start school in the classroom for 2 weeks before shifting all classes online. Even as the governor chastises people for not wearing masks, some stores have said they won't enforce that policy for fear of making employees unsafe. The Mecklenburg Board of Elections okays Bank of America Stadium and Spectrum Center as early voting polling places to help ensure social distancing. And Charlotte's Major League Soccer team gets a name and a logo, though they won't play until 2022. Here to update us on all that and more is Annie Ma, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Good morning, Annie.
Good morning.
Joe Bruno is here. He's a reporter for WSOTV, SOCTV, Channel 9, Eyewitness News. Joe, good morning to you.
Hey, Mike.
Jonathan Lowe, same name as before, is a reporter anchor with Spectrum News 1, a new name. Good morning to you.
Yes, sir. Good morning to you.
Got your shirt on and everything. And Steve Harrison is here. He is WFAE's political reporter. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Mike.
We're on the radio. We're also on Facebook Live. And let us begin today with politics and political conventions.
Yeah, we're going to Jacksonville. Ain't never coming back.
Now, we had already gone to no expense to produce that new theme for our coverage of the GOP convention, and that was it. But late yesterday afternoon, during his second coronavirus press conference of the week, President Trump pulled the plug on the Jacksonville convention.
The timing for this event is not right. It's just not right with what's happened recently, the flare-up in Florida. To have a big convention, it's not the right time. So I told my team it's time to cancel the Jacksonville, Florida component of the GOP convention.
Did anyone see this coming? Steve, did you see this coming?
I think the big turning point was earlier this week when the Republican sheriff in Duval County came out and really said, we're not prepared for this. Security wise, we can't do this. And I think that was important because one of the big reasons to move this to Jacksonville was it was a very Republican area, Republican mayor, Republican city council, Republican sheriff. And to have a Republican sheriff come out and really kind of trash the whole idea, I think that was pretty devastating. There was also a vote coming up in city council on it next week that might not have passed.
Yeah, I think one of the city, go ahead.
To add to Steve's point, I mean, when it initially was announced that Jacksonville was going to host the major part of the convention, I do remember the sheriff there in Duval County also saying that they were going to enforce people wearing masks within indoor facilities, which we know has been a contention point and sticking point. So the sheriff there has been upfront and honest about, you know, the pandemic and the impact down there in Florida.
And I think one of their city council members said it was going to be irresponsible to hold this in that environment. But the other thing is you can't really blame Jacksonville. They had 2 months to prepare for something that Charlotte has been working on for 2 years. And I read a story the other day, and I don't know how accurate it is, but it said essentially that the convention committee down there kept wanting to move these events. They would change their mind about what venue they were going to place certain events in, and they're 2 weeks out. So there was no way to prepare for security.
I mean, just, Mike, I think it was last week we found out that it was going to be both indoor and outdoor, and that they were going to be using that they couldn't get the mass gathering that the president had called for. So they were going to have everyone at different venues across Jacksonville, both indoor and outdoor. And I mean, that just came out in the last week. So things have started to kind of crumble slowly but surely there with this event in Jacksonville.
The president's poll numbers indicate trouble, at least at the moment. A lot could change between now and November, but they indicate trouble for his reelection prospects. And this week he seems to be in the midst of some sort of a rehabilitation campaign. He is suddenly and noticeably more reasonable about his expectations surrounding the virus. His critics had been taking him to task for a seeming lack of empathy on his part for those who have contracted this disease and died from it. And so yesterday he spent time expressing his concern for those who are suffering, and he expressed his concern for others in his convention canceling statement.
It's really something that, for me, I have to protect the American people. That's what I've always done. That's what I always will do. That's what I'm about. They said, sir, we can make this work very easily. We have great enthusiasm, incredible enthusiasm. Even the polls say about the most enthusiasm they've seen. We can do this safely and we can do it responsibly. And I said, there's nothing more important in our country than keeping our people safe.
Well, that's true. But will this be viewed as credible, given his push to have this convention up to this point in time in Jacksonville as a full-fledged convention, or will people see this as a political move, a tip of the hat to reality?
I don't think the president would get a whole lot of points or credit for canceling the event, and that people will somehow see, you know, that he's a changed person in terms of his views on the virus. I think it's interesting, just looking at the presidential race, there's still a lot of time left, but just, I feel like people haven't been particularly paying attention to it because there's, of course, so much else going on, right? We're so obsessed with coronavirus. And so the president loses the convention, which was a 3-day commercial. He just doesn't have that many opportunities left until the debates to get people's attention and speak to them on his own terms without, I don't know. I think it's just interesting that, there is a lot of time left, but in a way there isn't, because there's not any big events coming up.
Yeah. We all know why the GOP convention was pulled from Charlotte and moved to Jacksonville. It was because Governor Cooper could not guarantee that the president could have a completely unfettered, normal convention without social distancing and without delegates wearing masks. So the president moved it to a place where he thought that could happen. But yesterday, he treated us to a bit of revisionist history.
We had a tremendous thing planned and a tremendous convention planned in North Carolina, and it would have been very good, but a much smaller version in Florida. But then we saw what was happening pretty quickly. We saw that the virus was coming up that coast. So
is there a scintilla of truth to that story, to that version of the story?
Well, he tweeted on Memorial Day that, and said Cooper was in a, quote, like, shutdown mood. So there was certainly, like, there's certainly some animosity that's not being conveyed in that recounting of what happened.
He wanted a full convention in Charlotte. Cooper's administration asked for plans for what happens if our coronavirus cases start to rise. How will you scale it down? The RNC wouldn't provide those plans, so they took it to Jackson.
So he now is saying that he's planning some sort of a convention type convention speech. He mentioned online. I'm sure that's not necessary because the networks would most likely cover it, his acceptance speech, as they will Joe Biden's. And he said his nomination would occur in Charlotte. Now, there are, I think, 1,300 some delegates who participate in the nomination process, but the business part of the convention, which is still scheduled to be held here in Charlotte, only includes about 256 people. So are more people now going to come to Charlotte to vote, Joe?
So the city of Charlotte is only planning at this point for those 300 or so delegates that they already agreed to with the RNC. The RNC told the city to stop spending money on this convention, so they did. They spent about $16.7 million on security. They want that money back. They don't want to keep spending money for this. And logistically and from a safety standpoint, it would be really impossible at this point to have a safe event if they scaled it up once again.
You know, I mean, I was going to say one more thing, Mike. I mean, like what Joe said, it's really hard to do it safely. And also, we're still under phase two. So, you know, per the governor's orders, you can only, the Republicans can only have 10 people indoors at a time. So I don't even know how this scaled down convention is going to work, right? I mean,
go ahead, Joe.
And on July 15th, last week, the city terminated their arena license agreement with the RNC. So the Spectrum Center is even out of the question.
I mean, and then I was going to say, Joe, it to our earlier point in talking about, or the opening of the show, early voting. There, the county's in the process of planning to make that an early voting site. So I'm, and it's not like that's something that can start, you know, the last week of October. I'm sure that they're planning for that now. So
I don't know the rules of the Republican National Convention, because it's up to the political parties about how they do this nominating process. But are we going to see vote by mail from delegates who can't be here for that business part of the convention? Are they going to vote by mail to nominate the president?
Someone described it to me as like a giant Zoom meeting.
Can you even do that? Can you put 1,700 people on Zoom at the same time? We can barely do five.
I tell you what, though, the thing that I'm curious about is, you know, the president says there's going to be virtual components to this and speeches, and I'm wondering if they'll find a way to broadcast those from Charlotte. So you can still have one or two people in a room and televise it to the world. But they haven't released any details on that. And the people I asked yesterday weren't really sure if that's a possibility or if it would happen.
And also, Mike, it seems to me that there's maybe some budding conversation about what Charlotte can maybe do amongst city council members. I mean, I think in some of the coverage I saw last night, I know Councilman Beccari was kind of alluding to that in a way of maybe still trying to seize upon some of the opportunities now that Jacksonville is not having it. But as early as this morning, Councilman Malcolm Graham, who has been a vocal opponent of Charlotte holding the RNC, he's been tweeting this morning. And if I can just, three specific tweets, he says, I will not support any expansion of the RNC in Charlotte. We agree to a business meeting of 300 delegates or less, and that is what they will get. He goes on, poor planning on the part of the president should not put at risk the public safety and health of our residents and frontline workers. And then finally, he tweeted, there is no second chance for the RNC in Charlotte. We deserve a better business partner in the planning of this the event. They blew it. Hashtag Charlotte News.
So a lot of things happen very quickly in this world in which we live today, and this just came down late yesterday afternoon. So given this change, we may have a lot more to say in future weeks about the RNC and its intersection with Charlotte. So we'll also have a new theme when we talk about that.
The party's over, and tomorrow starts the same old thing again.
Okay. On to more serious topics. More than 106,000 positive cases of coronavirus have been reported in the state since March. 1,892 cases, I believe, were reported yesterday. Hospitalizations rose by a record to 1,188. As of last Sunday, when numbers are released, Mecklenburg reported 16,647 cases and 179 deaths, with 3 in 4 reported cases among adults 20 to 59 years old. And State Health Director Dr. Mandy Cohen put all those numbers into perspective earlier this week.
Here in North Carolina, this pandemic remains at a simmer, not a boil. We can and must avoid becoming the next Arizona or the next Florida.
Given what we're witnessing in Arizona and Florida and Texas and elsewhere, and given the fact that a lot of us don't social distance and we're having problems with people wearing masks, et cetera, in Mecklenburg County, how have we managed to not be like Arizona, Texas, and Florida?
I'd say the big reason is that we are still in phase two, and that officially bars never opened, large events never were never allowed. And so, like Mandy Cohen said, it's been on a simmer. We've seen this kind of steady increase of cases, but no explosion. And then the good news is that the test positivity has kind of stabled or going down.
And we'll be right back with more on that topic and more. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins along with Annie Ma from the Charlotte Observer. Joe Bruno is here from Channel 9 Eyewitness News. Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News 1. And Steve Harrison is here, our political reporter at WFAE News. Masks have become very political. There's a lot of news flying around about retailers, and we're going to talk about that, asking you to wear a mask but not enforcing the policy. And Dr. Robert Redfield, who is the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, was in Mecklenburg County recently, and when he was here, he too spoke about masks.
I think it's important, again, to emphasize, you can't emphasize it too much, that actually face coverings work. It's our major defense to prevent ourselves from getting this infection. If all of us would put on a face covering now for the next 4 weeks to 6 weeks, I think we could drive this epidemic to the ground in the country. So hopefully there'll continue to be more emphasis on that. I'm proud of the emphasis that North Carolina and Mecklenburg County has put on it.
And the president seems to have changed his stance on masks in the last couple of days. And also this week, Governor Roy Cooper was the most forceful he's been in pushing for mask wearing.
For those who continue to defy basic decency and common sense because they refuse to wear a mask, either wear one or don't go in the store. The refusal to wear a mask is selfish. It infringes on the life and liberty of everyone else in the store. Not only is wearing a mask the decent, neighborly thing to do, it's the best way to boost our economy.
Is that approach going to resonate? I mean, that's something that we used to think of ourselves as doing. And in America, we have this tradition of voluntarism that doesn't really exist, we are told, in the rest of the world, where we have neighbors helping neighbors who are in need. This is a situation very much like that, it seems to me. Is that approach, the way he staged that comment, going to resonate?
I don't know. You know, Annie made a point last week that has stuck with me for a week, and it defines this whole mask argument. And she mentioned the fact that if we look at history with seatbelts, you remember talking about that, Annie, last week?
Yeah,
and how people really pushed back on seatbelts. Now, in 2020, I don't think anybody would question, like you said, Annie, wearing a seatbelt. It's the same thing. It's like wearing a mask maybe 20 years from now, once we have a chance to look back on this and see how detrimental it was not wearing a mask, that we'll say, you know, it won't be even be a question. One can hope that in 20 years we will have learned from this. But it's similar to what Annie was talking about. And I think the governor's approach is kind of speaking to that.
Joe?
You know, I'm starting to notice some businesses are taking tougher stances on masks now. Southwest Airlines, for example, said you have to wear a mask or don't come on our flights. Even if you have a medical condition, wear a face shield. And if you can't do that, then we're sorry, we can't accommodate you. And I do think more businesses are going to start taking that hard line stance. And you know what? I do think, though, that slowly people are starting to come around and masks are slowly being embraced by more people. But I'm not sure it's as happening as quickly as leaders would like to see it happen.
And even with the airlines, you know, they've gone a step further just in the last 24 hours. Southwest, United, and American. Now, any part of the airports, from the time that when you enter the airport to leave to the time you land and exit, whatever part of the airport that is operated by that airline, you have to wear a mask now, or they will ban you from flying. So at least the airlines are taking that stance that Joe's talking about.
So airlines are getting tough, and we see national retailers like Walmart and the Home Depot and Kroger, which owns Harris Teeter, and Publix and other grocers, including Whole Foods, now instituting this policy requiring all employees to wear masks, and asking shoppers to come into the store with masks. But now Lowe's Home Improvement, who has asked shoppers to do just that, said it will not allow its workers to enforce the company's mask-wearing mandate. And there's a story in The Observer this morning about a Lowe's in California where One customer confronted another for not wearing a mask, and the customer not wearing a mask spit in the other customer's face. Lowe's has said safety has been and continues to be our priority. We will not ask our associates to put their safety at risk by confronting customers about wearing masks.
It sounds like you need a loss prevention officer or someone at the front door enforcing that. Then
that's my point. If I go to Lowe's today and shoplift, and they see me, they will stop me
and walk and follow you out to your car, do everything they can to keep you from stealing that item.
So what's the difference? Okay.
Well, I think it's a lot to ask. And I think like the tenor of a lot of these confrontations has just gotten more and more heated. Like my friend lives in Los Angeles, and she was telling me about a restaurant that closed, not because there was a COVID case there, not because of funding reasons, but because customers who were asked to put on their masks were like attacking or like throwing things at servers.
So you call security.
Yeah, that, you do. But I don't know if like what considerations Lowe's is making, but just the narrow thing of our store associates should not be throwing themselves into these fights. I can see where they're coming from there.
I agree with that. Absolutely. Yeah. An employee should not be put in that situation, but that's why, like, that's, you wouldn't have a store associate. I've worked in retail before. They go through training where they tell you, do not engage with someone that you suspect of shoplifting. So as Mike was saying, you would assume the same thing would be true for if you have a mask requirement for that store, that you wouldn't put an associate in that situation. That's a job of these major retailers. They have risk management departments. These are people who watch cameras. They are in the business of enforcing the security and the safety of the store. So to your point, Mike, if you're not going to put an associate in that position, isn't that the role of a safety and security officer?
Joe.
It's frustrating that weeks later, we're still having the conversation.
It is.
Just a mask. Put it on. You don't look stupid. Everyone else is wearing them. If you can't wear a mask, wear a face shield, a bandana, a t-shirt, anything else, just wear the mask.
The science on it is very, very clear. If you don't believe it, just go and watch a video of droplets that they've shown traveling through the air. When you're talking, coughing, sneezing, anything, the science is clear.
Yesterday, we did a whole hour with the schools about safety precautions that they're taking as they try to reopen schools in Mecklenburg County, at least, Annie. And one of the things they talked about was on buses and going into schools, they're going to ask students to wear masks, and they're going to provide masks for students entering school buses if they don't have them, but they are not going to make them wear the mask. They will not be denied a seat on the bus if they don't have a mask and refuse to put one on. What am I missing here?
I listened to yesterday. I was not on yesterday's show, but I listened to it to get up to speed on everything. And that was not something that had been said in a forum where I heard it before. Maybe I missed it in one of the very long board meetings, but that's kind of news to me. I think similarly, the consideration is being made that for these school buses, they said they weren't going to pursue having adult supervisors on there. So like the only adult is the bus driver. I don't really know the internal thinking behind it, but like my speculation is that's probably where their considerations are coming from. Some would say you should just leave the kid at the bus stop, you should send them home, but there are like huge liability risks with that too.
And they said they absolutely would not leave a child at the bus stop.
Right. Which I think is probably good, but
the president, as I said, has changed his tone on wearing a face mask in recent days. He now says he's been characterizing it as wearing as a personal choice, despite health recommendations. But now he's urging people to wear face masks, citing the spike in cases in the Sun Belt. And he also reversed his rosy outlook a bit by saying that the pandemic will likely, unfortunately, get worse before it gets better. When you combine that statement with his other more rosy statements about wearing a face mask and those of health professionals, do you think people who have not been wearing face masks because they are following the example set by the president will now change their tune? Will it be easier for them to now abide with the face mask rules?
I think so. I mean, I think that there's a, I think it helps. And I think that, you know, in the last few weeks, I think on Fox News, there's been a change in terms of some of the hosts urging people to do it. And kind of what Joe said earlier, I mean, just when I go out, the change over the past month, my limited, you know, going to the grocery store, going to Lowe's, I can't remember the last time I saw someone at the grocery store without one. Yeah. So I think slowly, day by day, more and more people are doing it.
And Jonathan,
see the opposite thing, especially across the street from me, where there is a large contingent of, across the street from where I live, there's a large contingent of people in the age group of 20 to 29. And they have consistently, I mean, I tweet about it on the weekend because it's just so bizarre. I mean, there's been a pool party every Saturday, and almost every Saturday and Sunday for the last 2 months. And what are we seeing with age group? It's like I'm seeing in front of my own eyes these numbers that we can consistently see. And no masks, large pool party, just hours on end. My opinion, I haven't seen much change.
And if you don't care about other people, or you just don't, you're just stubborn and you don't want to wear a mask, people should know about the story you did, Jonathan, on Monday, because evidently humans are spreading COVID to their pets.
Yes. We heard about this out of, you know, the tiger at the zoo, but this came out initially last weekend in South Carolina. A German shepherd caught COVID-19 from its owner. The pet did have a pre-existing condition. So they don't know if the COVID worsened that or not, but because of that, the dog did have to be put down. So, you know, the science on this has been back and forth, but the CDC now has a section on their website about how, you know, pets, both dogs and cats can get it from their humans, and cats can pass it from one another.
So that means wearing a mask at home. That means wearing your mask at home and in the grocery store and everywhere.
Well, I mean, if you have a household, the veterinarian that I talked to said, if you're a household where there's a COVID positive patient, you need to socially distance from your pet. That can be hard. You know,
our hospitals, unlike hospitals in some of the hot zones, seem to be handling this influx. There is an influx of COVID-19 patients in Novant and Atrium hospitals, but we're seeming to be able to handle that at the moment with no problem. Mecklenburg County Health Director Gibby Harris has said that they are, though, however, keeping an eye on South Carolina, where the number of cases is soaring.
So we have been having conversations with our local hospitals about the impact that we're seeing from other jurisdictions, in particular in South Carolina. South Carolina is seeing significant increases and is of real concern to us because of its close proximity to Mecklenburg County. We'll have to watch that carefully, but we do know that our hospital systems serve a region. They don't just serve Mecklenburg County. And individuals who are impacted by this in South Carolina may actually access service here.
And while we may seem to be aware of the situation in the Palmetto State, Vice President Mike Pence appears to be clueless about it. He was in Columbia this week to applaud that state's response to the virus, including their school reopening plan that has Governor Henry McMaster at odds with public schools down there. Pence was asked by WIS-TV in Columbia if, in hindsight, there is anything the Trump administration would have done differently.
I must tell you that I couldn't be more proud of this president's leadership and the early and decisive action that has allowed us to take the steps that we have taken.
Okay. This week, Mecklenburg County Manager Dina DiIorio imposed new rules on alcohol sales in the city of Charlotte, all the unincorporated areas of the county, and the towns of Davidson, Matthews, Mint Hill, and Pineville.
This revised proclamation is designed to put a stop to the behaviors we have seen in recent weeks, where we have seen videos of establishments where patrons are not wearing masks and social distancing has been non-existent. It is unfortunate that we must take these steps due to the poor decisions by some bad actors.
So this took effect last night, on Thursday night. What does this ban do or prohibit? Joe?
So it bans alcohol. Restaurants that serve alcohol cannot serve on-site consumption after 11 o'clock now. If the restaurant does not serve alcohol, they can remain open for on-site consumption. An example of that is like a Waffle House. It also bans the sitting and standing inside bar areas, and that applies to the restaurants that serve alcohol as well.
The CDC's Robert Redfield, who was here in Mecklenburg County, also brought this up recently.
I do think it's critical that we recognize that certain businesses that have a tendency to facilitate irresponsible behavior, such as bars that stay open late in the evening, I think really at this point in time in the epidemic, from the point of view of public health, they need to be closed. So I'm a strong advocate of closing bars, and I remain to be an advocate of limiting the restaurants so that there's adequate social distancing.
Has he been saying that during those White House briefings that he used to participate in back in the day? Or is this something new on his part?
He didn't bring this up voluntarily. He responded to a question about it.
Okay. Mecklenburg County is not alone in this late-night alcohol sale ban. Raleigh banned alcohol sales this week between 11 p.m. and 7 a.m. in bars, restaurants, and grocery stores. Orange County banned alcohol sales after 10 p.m. earlier this month in restaurants, private clubs, and other food service establishments. Do you understand how this helps? Explain to me how this helps. If you can gather, you can eat, you can drink in a restaurant, in a bar, before 11 p.m., what is the magic witching hour all about?
So here's the deal. You think about these videos that have surfaced. It's people packing into a so-called restaurant that is basically a nightclub where there's very few masks and little to no social distancing. And the odds are, if you're going to go out in Charlotte and rage and dance and do all that other stuff, it's going to happen after 11 o'clock. So when they put this 11 o'clock ban, that's what they're really aiming to do, is eliminate nightlife in Charlotte. It's young people who are getting all of these cases pretty much across statewide, and they may not be dying at a troubling rate, but they can certainly spread this virus to people who are. So that's their goal here, is just shutting down nightlife and prohibiting people from congregating in these settings late at night with a lot of alcohol in their system, all up on top of each other.
Well, we'll see if it works, because I picked up some food 2 days ago at a restaurant that has a big bar, and there were must have been 15 people at the bar sitting, drinking, talking, and it was 7 o'clock. What's the difference between 7 and 11, except for a retail store? We have to stop. We'll come back with more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We have our reporters gathered here for the local news roundup. They include Steve Harrison from WFAE News, our political reporter, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News One, an anchor reporter there, Joe Bruno reports for WSSC-TV, Channel 9, and Annie Maus, the education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Yesterday, Annie, on this program, I know you listened because you just said so, we had a bunch of people on from CMS, and including our own education reporter, Andos Helms, to talk about what the plans are for these opening weeks of school, which are now just a couple of weeks ahead. The school board met on Tuesday. They had to choose between column A, column B, column C, but they tossed away column A, which would have been all classes in classrooms all the time from the beginning of time, but they chose plan B with a plus to it. So what is the plan, Annie Ma? What do students and parents and faculty face?
So students and parents will have a different experience than teachers, but the first 2 weeks of school will follow an in-person rotational socially distanced plan. So students will be there, three groups of students there for 3 to 4 days, depending on how you split the days. And they will be meeting with teachers, getting their materials, getting to know each other, the teachers in a socially distant fashion. The idea behind this like 2-week in-person orientation is to help kids build some form of connection with their teachers, so they're more, so they know who they're talking to. It's not just a face on a screen. It's someone they've met in person. It's someone they've talked to. It's someone they've worked with before. And the hope is that it'll make remote learning go off a lot more smoothly if you have those connections to fall back on and have that kind of feeling that you're part of a class, that you're actually part of a school. Parents have the option from now, and I believe the deadline is Sunday, to opt into the virtual academy, where you would keep your school placement, but you wouldn't go to the in-person orientation period. You'd have a different set of teachers, but the biggest difference is that if things change in Mecklenburg County to the point that CMS does go back to a rotational in-person or whatever from the remote period after the orientation, that if you're in the virtual academy, you'll stay virtual until the end of the first semester. And in December, you'll have an option to opt in or out of following the district-wide response plan to the Mecklenburg County's metrics.
They're offering something similar in Wake County, and I'm told that in the first week of opening registration for that, they had 40% of parents signing their kids up for the Remote Learning Academy. You have to register in Mecklenburg by 11:59 p.m., this Sunday night. So do we have any idea how many people have already signed up?
I don't know as of now. I imagine it's ballooned since yesterday's virtual Q&A about the academy. I think a lot of parents had questions and they were holding off until they heard from the district to get some of those things clarified. But I do know that I can't remember when the registration opened, but I believe on Tuesday, so it was around 24, 48 hours in, there were 15,000 families signed up, and that's about 10% of the district. People like me tend to wait till the deadline to do things, particularly if it's a big decision. So I would not be surprised to see that shoot up over the weekend. And even now, I'm sure it's a lot higher than it was on Tuesday.
And you do that on the CMS website, that's easy to find, and most parents know what that website is. School officials have promised a better, improved, streamlined, effective online education experience, not just in the online academy, but after the first 2 weeks when everything goes online for the students who go to those first 2 weeks of school. Do you know what that means, how they're making this better than it was in the spring?
Well, I think something that when I talk to teachers that I've heard a lot of them emphasize is like, you have to remember that in March, it was like, oh no, go home, go teach, go forth. And so it was very chaotic. They were trying to figure out how to adjust to a pandemic, how to adjust their lives, and how to suddenly move teaching to an online platform without the infrastructure that they've spent the summer building. They've talked about this they talked about the curriculum side of this a lot in board meetings and presentations, and the sense is that over the summer they've built out frameworks for classes virtual curriculum and templates is the best word to use that kind of hit all the high points using like a virtual platform for things, and they've kind of figured out a way to balance synchronous and asynchronous learning, basically live sessions versus pre-recorded sessions. There is a video out there that CMS produced about what a virtual lesson will look like, and it's pretty informative. It kind of just shows you, like, if you're in the remote classes, this is what your experience will be like. So it's definitely something that they've put a lot more thought into because they've had the whole summer to prepare, as opposed to, oh my God, Monday we're online.
So the decision to go back to school for 2 weeks, which happens to be the incubation period for coronavirus, has been not without some pushback from some teachers. They had a virtual Zoom meeting about this, the school board did, on Tuesday evening. And here are just a sample of some of the concerns brought up by teachers.
After months of working so hard to stay safe, we will be forced back into poorly ventilated classrooms with students and coworkers potentially carrying the virus with only a mask between us. I am frightened that those 2 weeks will result in student infections, teacher infections, and ultimately infections all over Charlotte.
Terrified, petrified, furious, panicked. These are the words that my coworkers use to describe their feelings about going back into our school building.
I've never been more scared in my entire life. This is not only our lives on the line, but the lives of our family members as well.
There's nothing that I would rather do than to start the school year in my classroom. You do not need to lecture educators on the social, emotional, educational, and mental benefits of in-person instruction. It is what we are trained to do. But if it is not safe to be in school April and May, it certainly is not safe in August.
We want to be back at school. It's just not safe. You know, we draw the line at dying. We should not have to sacrifice our lives.
Are these teachers in the minority, or are they expressing the concerns of the majority of faculty and staff, Jonathan?
I think it's the majority. And just talking to some of the education advocates that I know really well. But, you know, if you look to South Carolina, this is not just, you know, we've made masks political and so many things in this pandemic political. But I think that the teachers across the board, across the nation, are concerned and they're scared about reopening schools. In August in South Carolina, the state superintendent is at odds with the governor on, you know, his requirement that any plan to go back and reopen schools has to have a 5-day in-person school option. You know, so I don't think it's just here in North Carolina that teachers are scared and rightfully so. It's across the nation.
And Joe, you
reported... And I don't think...
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I don't think it's as simple as like teachers are scared. I think one teacher that I can't remember who it was put it really well. It's like historically in North Carolina and in other states, the culture has kind of demanded a lot of teachers. We tell them to do more with less and more with less every single year. And this just feels like it's crossing the line, right? You like, how are you supposed to do more with less when it's an issue of your safety, the student's safety, and your coworkers and your family's safety? And I think that's what they're trying to point out, is like, they're not happy with the working conditions and how little say they've had. It's not simply like, oh, I'm scared to go back.
And Joe, you reported that almost all the 40 plus people who signed up to speak spoke in opposition to the plan to go back. Not all of these people were teachers. So were their objections similar to those of what we just heard from those teachers?
Well, the board also heard from parents who were opposed to the plan because they don't think kids are in school enough. They think they heard what Robert Redfield said when he was here. They're worried about the emotional and social support of these kids, and they think that they should be back in the classroom. Some parents think that teachers are trying to take advantage of the situation so they can go tutor on their free time, which there's no actual basis for that. But there were parents who spoke at this meeting, and they had legitimate concerns about how they can juggle their careers and their child's educational work.
And I think, I was just going to say, Mike, I think it's going to be important for CMS, and they've kind of talked about this, they're going to try and come up with some metric to determine when they can go back. And I do think that's important to hear, for parents to hear the goal and what the community is working toward. Because I do think parents want to know kind of what the end game is.
And I think I heard earlier this week the answer to that is a vaccine. I don't think that there will be enthusiasm about reopening and going back until there's a vaccine, which is the case for a lot of things.
Well, national polls show small but slightly increasing support for going back into the classroom. About 36% of parents in the National Parents Union poll favored going back to school, 36%. The EdChoice poll showed only 26% of parents favor returning to classrooms, with 40% of those parents saying they were not comfortable at all with the idea of sending kids back into classrooms. Most parents in those and other polls say that schools should err on the side of safety. That's not what CMS parents are saying?
I think it's not what the most vocal CMS parents are saying. The ones who have really kind of come out to criticize the board have been the ones who are calling on the schools to reopen.
So I asked CMS school board chair. Go ahead, Joe.
Kids are getting this virus at, you know, not very troubling rates. And the ones that are, their symptoms are incredibly mild. The problem is, though, teachers are the ones at risk. So, you know, parents might want to kids back because their kids will be fine.
I'm not sure that that's true, and that's part of the mixed messaging, because yesterday, correct, I believe it was, the Centers for Disease Control pointed out that kids 10 and older are just as susceptible of catching, spreading, and coming down with this virus as in a full-fledged adult. And yesterday in Florida, I think a 9-year-old died from the virus. And I asked CMS Board Chair Elise Dashew yesterday on this program but whether she felt it would be better to err on the side of safety. She defended the plan, and she said that she believes CMS can keep our children safe for the 10 days that they'll be in the classroom.
It's just not easy. There is just no right answer.
Would it be better to err on the side of safety?
You know, based on what I understand from the county health experts and our private health experts, I think we're going to be okay here. But I understand the fear that people are feeling.
Matthews Town Commissioner Ken McCool said he has been unable to get concrete answers from board members to questions about IT support for remote learning, how much teacher input has been sought, how social distancing could be maintained at lunch, about how many people had signed up for remote learning. And he said it's becoming increasingly clear, this is a quote, that CMS is not prepared for our teachers to return to work in 2.5 weeks. CMS must answer these questions and the questions from the rest of the Matthews Board of Commissioners, and they must do so transparently. They are limiting the number of kids on a bus to 24 with one child per seat, but once again, they're leaving it up to the bus drivers to police that, and the bus driver is driving the bus. I've been on a school bus. Kids don't sit still. Has all of this been set, all of these plans, have they been satisfactorily explained? Or are they just a little bit fuzzy on a lot of things? And has anybody talked about, because I asked this question yesterday, and it was clear that it was a new question, has anybody talked about liability issues?
Well,
I don't think that anybody's talked about liability issues, and I think that many of the stakeholders, from parents to teachers to other elected officials, clearly feel that they have not gotten sufficient answers from the board.
Mike, I was just going to add that we even had a report that earlier this week. Our Reuben Jones talked to a number of the private schools in the area, and they say that they have seen an increase in calls from parents wanting their, because schools like Charlotte Catholic and Country Day are planning to go back. And we were even in, he was able to go into a classroom. And so you're seeing desks with those plastic partitions, but you know, maybe parents are now, you know, not only looking at the virtual option, but also going to private school as an option as well.
And to be fair, there are very, very, very good reasons to go back to school. Some of the things we haven't talked about, like some of these kids depend on school breakfasts and school lunches. Sometimes teachers see things in the kids that need to be reported to Child Protective Services, and they're the front line for that. And also, kids need the discipline of being in a classroom in order to understand how the educational process works. And many of them have never experienced that because they're going into kindergarten or first grade, and many of them lost that experience at the end of last semester. So there are good reasons. And Jonathan, you reported that some athletic supporters and athletes are asking that CMS at least let them practice and play.
Absolutely. They even held a rally, a good number, I would say at least 200 student athletes from across the district, parents, coaches, administrators, held a rally in the parking lot of CMS on Wednesday, asking that they not only, like you said, allow off-season workouts, but be able to have some sort of season if the State High School Association allows it.
So very quickly, the Washington Redskins will be called the Washington Football Team this year, and we just got a name for Charlotte Soccer.
Our name is Charlotte Football Club, but we are bigger than one city.
We were born an expansion team.
We don't believe in starting small.
We only know how to go big.
To play big, it takes all of us.
If you love the beautiful game, you belong here.
If you call the Carolinas home, you belong here.
We are made of North and South. We come from around the world.
We play as one.
Jugamos como uno.
We are Charlotte FC.
welcome to the club.
But they won't play now until 2022. Steve Harrison, Joe Bruno, Jonathan Lowe, Annie Moth, thank you all for being part of the program today. Stay safe. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.